Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden, and it's an absolute privilege to have you join us today. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time because it's such a timely topic, and really looking forward to digging into this crucial conversation with two globally respected thought leaders. For those of you who are return listeners to this live event, welcome, and return listeners to the podcast, always great to have you join us. For those of you who are new to the Do Good to Lead Well universe, a heartfelt welcome as well. And I want to take a moment to acknowledge your incredible support, your feedback, your social shares, everything else that you've done, suggestions for great topics and guests. Do Good to Lead Well is now ranked in the top 0.5% of podcasts globally, and that could have never happened without your ongoing support. And as I mentioned, this is such a conversation that I've been looking forward to having with James White and Krista White, the best-selling authors of Anti-Racist Leadership. And James White is a transformational leader with over 30 years of experience as a CEO, operating executive and board member, as chair, president, and CEO of Jamba Juice East Bay from 2008 to 2016. He transformed the company's DEI practices, resulting in a 500% increase in the company's market cap. In 2020, he launched his own firm, Culture Design Lab, to coach, train, and lead CEOs, boards, chief people officers, and chief diversity officers on operationalizing his diversity, equity, and inclusion playbook. Krista is a writer and consultant in the DEI space, highly sought after and respected consultant, focusing on work at the intersection of race and queerness, and is the co-founder of the Culture Design Lab. And this is just scratching the surface here. So many amazing accolades that we could talk about and the extraordinary work that you do. So Krista, James, a very warm welcome to the program.
Craig, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, and what I love is I often have one guest. This is great. This is going to be like a Newfoundland kitchen party. I'm from Newfoundland originally, so having that conversation, we have friends joining us from around the world today. I have my copy, and it's a great read. Congratulations. The accolades that have come through, the attention that it's garnered, so well received. I'd love for you to start with, what prompted you to write this book?
I think if we go back in time, and I'll have Krista to kind of compliment my memory of how we began, but I had one of the boards that I sat on 4 years or so ago, and the CEO at the time asked me to really try to help them think about their people system, make them more inclusive. And I invited Krista, who was a brilliant writer and researcher, to join me on this project. And very quickly, we found a passion around this work of inclusion and diversity that I don't think we knew prior to that time that we mutually shared. So we actually came out of that project, ended up forming Culture Design Lab, and took on several other customers. And two or three customers in, we look at each other and say, there's actually a gap in the world around this discussion, you know, from the perspective of a board member operating executive to really tackle this critically important issue that we view to be foundational. And Krista's millennial perspective with my own just ended up being a force multiplier. And the rest, as they say, is history. a lot of what ended up in the final delivery of the book was catalyzed by the tragic events of 2020, not the least of which was the tragic murder of George Floyd and many others. So, Chris, yeah. I don't know if you'd add anything.
Yeah, I would just add that as a collaboration came about in a time that was extremely timely, we started working shortly before the pandemic, but throughout the peak of the pandemic, it was really an energizing way to work together and get to see each other virtually all the time. And it couldn't have been more timely, as Dad said, with the racial reckoning of the summer of 2020. And it just kind of blossomed our collaboration, the way we work together from there.
Well, and I'd love to, that combination, the dynamic duo, if you will, the father-daughter combination, I'd love to hear. So what was that process like, collaborating on a book? So as father-daughter, what, talk about how that really impacted, inspired each of you and how it contributed to the evolution of the book and the final product, which, as I said, is just terrific.
And maybe one of the places to start is I often read or will ask Krista to read the opening paragraph of the book. Craig, if you allow us to do that. Krista, do you want to do the honors or should I?
Do you mind doing it? I don't have one right next to me.
Okay. I always have mine right next to me. But I'll read the opening paragraph, which really I think speaks volumes to the way we collaborated, why the collaboration was so important. And again, this is the opening paragraph of our book, Anti-Racist Leadership. This book is not apolitical. This book is explicitly anti-racist, pro-Black, pro-LGBTQIA+, and feminist. This book takes the stance that Black lives matter, that LGBTQIA rights are human rights, that people of all abilities deserve respect and access, and that people of all genders have the right to sovereignty over their bodies and identities. This book acknowledges that capitalism is built on a foundation of systemic racism, and that to have a truly diverse, equitable, and inclusive work environment, we must acknowledge the historic and present injustices faced by marginalized people. And really the backstory on that paragraph, we had started working on the project some 6 months prior to the murder of George Floyd, but around June 1 of 2020, Krista comes to me and said, Dad, I've got a different way for us to start the book. And it was that paragraph, almost unedited. We knew we'd be talking with the team that was working with us on the book. So as Krista reads that paragraph to me, I, you know, kind of fall back a bit in my seat and absorb it overnight. We have the meeting the next day. I go on to read that paragraph to the team working around us. And the response was, well, James, you're a mainstream business person. Do you care if you ever work again? And without hesitation, you know, my response is, this is a book whose time has come. We can't straddle the fence. We really need to, you know, kind of stand tall and lead in this moment where people are looking for voices and leadership. And this was really Krista pushing her dad to really say, you know, we've been at this for, you know, many, many decades, and we really need to call things exactly what they are. Language is really important, and we need to, you know, stand tall and steady in the moment. Krista, anything you'd add?
Yes, I would say I agree. It was really important to me in that moment of where we were really at a boiling point to take a strong stance as Black folks, as Black leaders, for a pro-Black stance, which to me is always going to be intersectional, is always going to include women, Black women specifically, but women in general, queer people, and other marginalized folks. So taking that stance from the very beginning was really important to me so that no one was unclear on where we stood. And I think that stating that this work is not apolitical is an important stance to take, especially in a space where this work is politicized. So we have to be honest about where we are. In an ideal world, I think it would not be political to say that Black Lives Matter or that human rights should be at the forefront of all of our work. But that is the reality that we live in. I just thought that it was important to state from the beginning.
Well, and thank you. And all received comments around that. Really appreciate setting the stage for the conversation. And for me, I love that you opened the book with the chapter Intentional Leadership Matters. And you both just touched on that idea. And I love that, that right out of the gate. Can you talk about the power of intention, why this is so important for these conversations?
I think there's a couple points that I'd make. The first point would be leaders always create the space for our best work. And kind of our premise and thesis around the book is that inclusive leadership lives in the context of a company's culture. And it starts at the top. You know, so we've got a thesis that says the CEO, she can't delegate this work. She must lead this work inside the company. And I think core to this work is the idea, and Craig, we've heard you in other discussions talk about how important empathy is. We actually believe empathy is a core capability of this next generation of leaders, having the capacity to walk in someone else's shoes, even if it's for a brief moment. We think creates an environment where we all can lead better and differently.
Yes, as you mentioned, the intentionality and the empathy piece, and we've also touched on the multi-generational workplace, which I've been thinking about a lot lately as, you know, Gen Z, the oldest members of Gen Z have begun to enter the workforce, and they're hearing the same things that we millennials heard, that they're lazy, that they're entitled. And I think that the empathy piece is important in leading a multi-generational workplace because it hints at looking at the full humanity of people and seeing people as individuals, as well as having compassion for these things that you might see as negative or an inconvenience. For example, I was just thinking about how the idea that Gen Z wants to do things their own way is seen as a negative, but I would like to flip that on its head and think about the way that they want to challenge the status quo, to question why we do things the way we do things and question what's not working, as well as be seen as their full selves. They want to be their full selves at work. Why should I have to hide part of who I am or my needs? And I think there's something to be learned from every generation, and it goes every direction of we can all learn something from each other. We can learn, and you know, traditional mentorship is the wisdom of people who have come before us who have all that experience and knowledge from their work. So I think it's important to honor that as well.
Well, and thank you. And again, lots of great comments coming through. And I love that you touch on the importance of empathy and already have a question on this. Brenda is saying, thank you for writing such an important book on such an important topic. I want to talk about the empathy piece. What are some skills that leaders need to develop to grow their empathy muscles? And I know you dedicate a lot of the book to that and lovely concrete examples. I'd love to get each of your take on that. How can we grow? How can we lead with more empathy?
I think there are opportunities for us in real and tangible ways. And we share a couple of examples in the book on ways that I've done that in my past as an executive, where I'll take white executives and take them to a Black MBA conference or a Hispanic or Latinx conference, where at least for a day or 2 days, they're the only one in the elevator, the only one in the restaurant, they're the only one in the meeting spaces. And it gives just a little bit of perspective around what it's like to be the only one in the room. In many of our executive spaces, as we're looking to be more inclusive and bring people from different backgrounds into the room. One of the specific examples that we share, which people I think get, you know, fantastic enlightenment out of, there was a white executive that worked for me, and we wanted him to be more sensitive from a gender perspective. So we sent him to a women's conference, and let's call there 500 women at this conference. There might have been 10 men in attendance. And the long and the short of the message is after about 8 hours sitting in the room, being the only man in the room, he was so physically and emotionally drained and exhausted, he couldn't make it to dinner. And kind of the point that we make, if you think about women that are sometimes the only one in business and executive spaces, or people of color that are the only ones in the room, like, I can't walk out of my skin. I'm going to always be a Black man as I enter any of the spaces I enter into. And just that little bit of an empathy, I think, made him a better executive, and he could see more explicitly maybe some of the challenges the women on his team had faced kind of over time, and how he might be a much better ally and leader and coach.
And I love the example of physically putting someone in a different person's shoes. I love that. Another one that I think is really important in, especially in one-on-one or small group interactions, is listening more than you talk, practicing that. As leaders often feel like they have to have all the answers. And to some extent, that is true. But there are times where you can sit back and let someone be the leader in their own lived experiences and listen to understand rather than to respond, which is just a lesson for all of us in our interpersonal interactions, but especially important here. And I think that it helps a lot for leaders to be vulnerable and transparent about where they are in their own journey. When it comes to work like anti-racism, it's sometimes hard for people to open up to, say, their CEO about what they're really dealing with because of these external pressures of, as a woman, maybe I don't want to be seen as weak, or as a person of color, I don't want to be seen as angry. Of course, the intersectionalities of those things. So I think that leaders need to lead the way in having those transparent conversations and model what it looks like to be open and honest about your experiences.
I love that. I love the idea of going first. I think that's awesome. And I love what you're talking about. Listen more than you talk. And I see the nods, and James, I saw with you too, that we've all been part of meetings where just talk, and taking that time to listen. And I love the point you're making, Krista, as well, about the listen for understanding, then responding, because so often we get distracted by that. No, I'm with you. And James, I love that example of, rather than saying, you know, walk a mile in someone's shoes and visualize, what I find is then we take our own lived experience and project that into someone else's. It's ourselves in their shoes. And I love what you're talking about and saying, hey, when you're there and when you're experiencing this firsthand, well, what an impact that has, and really start thinking about that. I've got a great, I'm not surprised, more questions coming in. Dave said, thank you. This is such an important conversation. I'm a white executive, and I'd love to have more constructive conversations around race in my team and organization. I'm not sure how to begin. Any advice on how I can do this thoughtfully?
I think you start where you are. I think as leaders, we've got to admit what we know and don't know. And I think Krista was making that point earlier. And I think we've all got to take ourselves on a learning journey. For me, one of the great lessons in writing this book with Chris is I think I learned more coming through this process than she did from Dan, you know, which was just fantastic. And it really changed my viewpoint of the world. And this was a true cross mentoring opportunity as we work on the book. And I think the executive who posed that question, I think there, if there is a genuine curiosity and interest in learning about people on your team that are different, with different background, different lived experiences. And really, the job of the leader is really creating space where we can all bring our full selves to the work. And I think what you find from a leadership perspective, you will garner more of the discretionary effort of the team if that's the approach that we take.
I definitely agree with that. I understand why you might be hesitant to get started, because these are really tough, sticky conversations. I'd also advise you to make sure you give yourself grace in this space. You might say something ham-handed or want to go back and restart a conversation, and that's okay. That's human. You're human, and part of acknowledging the full humanity of everyone else is acknowledging your full humanity. And I think that's something that can get lost under racism and white supremacy, is also not to center whiteness, but that white people lose some of their full humanity as well. So acknowledging who you are and everything about you that has shaped where you are now.
And I think one of the important points that Krista made is about being human. When I end up in some of the highly politicized conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion, one of the comments I make now to kind of center the discussion, this is just about being human. This is about creating fair and equal opportunity for just all the humans in the company, in the enterprise. And that's something that is kind of hard for anybody to push back on. Mm-hmm. In one comment, to quote Krista, if you can design systems and processes that work for the most marginalized people, they typically work pretty well for everybody else.
No, and thank you. And again, lots of comments there. And thank you, Phoebe, for thought, and appreciate the comment about bringing grace with that and recognizing, and it's a human journey. And I also think that's wonderful. I have another question from Evelyn, who's wondering, so what do organizations get right when it comes to creating their DEI programs? And what are some common missteps you see that organizations make on the DEI front?
I think two points that I'd make. I think when there is authentic and kind of genuine commitment to going on a journey. So we talk about in the book a number of CEOs that have taken both themselves and their corporations on learning journeys. One of my favorites is the CEO at Snook Supermarkets in my hometown of St. Louis, Missouri, Todd Snook. As all this was happening in 2020, he made a personal commitment with his leadership team to have the work that they would do around diversity, equity, and inclusion at the forefront of how he moved the corporation forward. So he's proceeded to add a meeting where he meets with the chief people officer, his head of DEI, and a couple line executives. And they've been meeting on a weekly basis for now almost 3 years. I'm a board member, happen to sit on the board. They bring me into the conversation, knowing kind of the breadth of my experience across multiple industries and corporations. So I enter the discussion with them on a monthly basis. We've been doing it for 3 years and counting. And the only thing that has shifted is that we have zoomed out and we're talking about culture more. And the way we think about it, anti-racist leadership, inclusive leadership lives in the context of culture. And that happens to be the space that Chris and I are spending a lot of time thinking about. And we think it'll end up being the next book we'll work on as we think about culture. You have to be intentional and manage and lead and shape culture. And it's never been more important than in this really chaotic environment we find ourselves in as leaders today.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Dad, about the work we've done in anti-racist leadership underpinning and flowing through to culture. I think sometimes their DEI and culture are looked at as separate aspects of a business and they're intertwined. I think it's really telling. The person asked about what are some missteps that we've seen. Some of the biggest missteps are not prioritizing DEI when the going gets tough. We've seen that in the DEI layoffs that have happened after the huge surge of hiring in 2020 and 2021. And I think that speaks to not seeing it as key to culture, when in fact it is an extremely important and essential aspect of your culture. You can't have a great culture, which in turn leads to better innovation and better retention, all of that. You can't have a great culture if you're not inclusive. You're not looking at people's needs and their diversity. So I think that not thinking about the long game is one of the biggest missteps I think we're seeing.
And maybe the only other point I'd make is DEI work is not about a month or an event. It's not transactional. This is about the fabric and foundation of building a great company. It's about values. In the best case scenario, is linked to the strategy of the enterprise and is thought about as a critical lever in shaping culture of the company.
Well, and such a great and important discussion here on multiple fronts. And I love that it's the long game, as you say, and it's not just a singular event. Okay, check this off the box. I think that's so powerful. And that it's an ongoing commitment. And James, as you talked about, linking it to our values, who we are, because that is such an integral part. And I love that linkage you make on the intentionality of the leadership. And Chris, to your point, which again, so when things, you know, the economy terms, oh, well, here's where we're going to go to look at the layout. So how does that say that's a priority? Well, what that means is, well, this is a nice to have, and we'll have this when we have the space and time, rather than this defines who we are. This is a critical part. And you do both. It's such a great job in the book where you highlight, well, let's embed this into the fabric of the organization. And it's a critical part for how we move forward together. So really great. Not surprised. More questions coming in. Tanya was asking, love the emphasis on building an inclusive culture, loving what you're sharing. What are some of the key things that we as leaders need to do to build as inclusive culture as possible?
I think a couple of the things that we suggest kind of in the book is, the first thing is to do an inventory of where you stand today. We describe it as almost like an anthropological lens that you bring to the corporation, where you understand what are the symbols, what are the processes that touch the humans inside the company. And you're doing it through the lens of thinking about, are there practices or policies inside our company to disadvantage any of the humans in the company? And then you do what we talk about as kind of a future back process, where you think about where you want to be. What's the ambition of the organization over 3 to 5 years? Describe that very clearly. And then you look at the gap between those two items and kind of build a roadmap, prioritize in a way. And it's going to always be custom to individual companies and the industries that they do business in. And then, you know, methodically and intentionally kind of march forward.
I'd agree with all of that. I'd also say that, you know, again, we've mentioned this, but encouraging continuous learning and learning for yourself as more information becomes available. So much we've learned, so much as a collective society in the past 5 years about everything from anti-racism to queerness to access for people with disabilities that we weren't, I don't think, collectively aware of before or not conscious to. And we have a long way to go, but I think that this speaks to the being aware of the long game as well, of having your organization be constantly learning and encouraging learning and development and taking yourself on a personal journey as well, staying engaged. It can be hard to stay engaged with these topics, but I'd encourage you to like really stay the course.
Well, and thank you both for that. And I appreciate taking that lens, you know, kind of that, and you mentioned that audit or anthropological perspective. Okay, where are we? Let's just get a sense of, let's do that diagnostic, an honest appraisal about where we are, and also appreciate that focus on continuous learning. This is a journey. You've touched on this before. And I love that idea. This is as a human experience. How can we continue to learn, grow, expand, challenge, reflect? All of these things are absolutely critical for that sustainability. Now, one of the points that you made in the book, and I really appreciated it, because a lot of times when people look at talent and hiring talent, they focus on cultural fit. And then you both challenge us, which I think is great. And you say, the better question is cultural enhancement. Can you talk about that idea? Because I think many people feel they're like, oh yeah, we need to make sure it's a fit. It's a fit. It's a fit. I love that you say, let's look at this through cultural enhancement.
Yeah, I think the way we thought about it is one way to exclude people is when you focus on how they fit your culture. So you're then looking for things to rule people out versus saying, are there things that Krista and James might be experiences that they bring to our company that would be additive and culture enhancing or an accelerator to this team? And it's just a different orientation where you're looking for the value in unique differences that might allow you to innovate differently or solve problems more completely because you had a perspective added to the team that wasn't there previously.
Yeah, and I think that language tweak helps you think in a way of growth rather than stagnancy, because if often culture fit might have you always hiring from the same five schools, even if you have some cultural diversity, you might not have any diversity of thought or class diversity. And those things are also very important when it comes to innovation.
And I love that point, and thank you both again. And I think that's what I loved about the tweaking of the question. It's a small shift, yet a powerful mindset shift in terms of, oh, okay, are we looking at the status quo? We talked about that before as well. And then fit is where we are versus, well, enhancement is, so how can we continue to grow, expand, be our best selves, diversify the input, the talent, the experiences, so we can really move forward together as an organization. So another question coming in from Lawrence, who says, our organization really wants to attract more diverse talent. We are struggling in that domain. Any tips, techniques that you've found to be particularly effective so we can be more effective in this important activity?
I think a couple quick thoughts. I think firstly, appreciate, spend time on thinking about how to retain the diverse talent that you have is kind of the place I'd always start. Some of that talent is a good resource to help you look at different places. So I think one of the places for a critical amount of diverse talent that people seemingly have discovered for the first time over the last few years is historically Black colleges and universities, which have always graduated more Black talent, as an example. There are historically predominant Hispanic institutions where there's, you know, fantastic talent as well. But the main message would be to just go to slightly different places to access talent and kind of open up the aperture to consider showing up different places to find talent. I'll give another example. Like the technology space is an area where there is typically a lack of Black talent. I spoke late last year at Afrotech. There were 20,000 aspiring, very talented engineers, folks in the technology space that happen to be Black from really all over the world. So I just think going to slightly different places and putting yourself in situations to attract different talent, but also you've got to create an environment inside the company to retain the talent that you have, and you've got to create a welcoming environment as you onboard this newly diverse talent that we're all adding, because what you don't want to do is attract folks in, but have them find a less than satisfying way they experience the company. So you've got to think about policies and practices that create a more inclusive environment as new people show up.
I love that point about nurturing the talent you already have. I think it speaks to taking a moment to pause. And it's similar to what we talked about with taking stock of where you are and understanding where the gap is that where you need to get to. So yeah, I love that point. I also think it's very important to be clear on what your goals and benchmarks are when it comes to creating a more diverse environment, attracting more diverse talent. And prepare any of your interviewers to answer some tough questions from people of color who said, well, why? Why are you not as diverse as you'd like? And where are you going?
Love that point. And I think it's such an important piece in terms of how thinking about where we are, where we're recruiting. Lauren said, fabulous to consider about. So what are the vehicles? Where are we finding this talent? I have another question from Tina, who And I know you talk about this in the book. She was mentioning, I'm curious about the trend where organizations are now hiring chief diversity officers. Any thoughts around that?
Well, certainly I'm a proponent of focus around diversity, equity, and inclusion. But I think the most critical thing that has to happen, there has to be a commitment at the top. I think the remit of that job and the folks that occupy that job have to be, they have to have the right remit. They need to have the authority and responsibility to really work with the management team and the CEO to shape culture. So one of the things I'm seeing more is the DEI roles that I've seen be the most effective, a part of the remit is culture. So the connectedness that Krista talked about of connecting DEI work to culture and values of the organization. But there's got to be the right reporting, right structure, really right remit for the role. I think we would advocate that role, depending on the size and structure of the company, reporting into the CEO. Second place would be the chief people officer. But my preference would be into the CEO. I view it as that important. And I think if you add to the remit leadership of shaping culture and engagement and building more inclusion in a corporation, that's where I would have the role report.
I agree with all of that. And to your point about it being a trend, that is one of our fears that we've kind of touched on of this work, you know, throughout the past 50, 60 years has come in waves. And our hope is that this wave has some sticking power to promote lasting change, promote lasting diversity, and that CDO can't be a figurehead. They can't be expendable. I can't remember the exact figure, but CDOs can have a very short tenure. So looking, like Dad said, looking at making sure they have the resources that they need and the power they need to really get the work done over a period of years.
And that's something I think you do a great job in the book is to say, okay, with these practices, even if they're well-intentioned practices, how are they sustainable? Let's be thoughtful around this. And I love that idea. And I'm so glad the question came up in terms of the trend. And as you pointed out, that can come in waves. And then to your points, which is around, so do they have the resources at their disposal? Do they have the mandate for change and how to bring this forward in the organization? I love, as you say, you know, reporting in directly to the CEO. And this, once again, an integral part of the C-suite. I have another question from Stephen saying, at our senior leadership table, sometimes people will say things that I feel go outside the bounds of an inclusive environment, yet I struggle with how to engage with that. Any advice for how I can speak up and challenge in these moments?
I think a good place to start, I mean, it would be great if you can disrupt the language and the discussion on the spot, but, you know, maybe a more comfortable place to start is to pull me aside and say, hey, James, you said something that didn't sit well with me. At least from my vantage point, I don't think this was your intention, but this is how I received it. And I think it might be helpful, you know, so you can have sidebar conversations that will be helpful. But I think we've all got to demonstrate the leadership courage without creating undue risk to kind of step into, you know, what is a void inside of some companies. And some of it is a lack of exposure. And that's one of the reasons to put ourselves in environments where we're around more people with different lived experiences and to be thoughtful about that. I think the lack of that leads to the ignorance in some of the conversations that have been pervasive throughout many companies for many, many years that will ultimately need to stop. I think the significant generational change that is starting to happen in the workforce, we've got the next two generations are going to be the most diverse that have ever been in the workforce. So we're actually going to need leaders that are more comfortable leading multiple generations, much more diversity. And I think the companies that get this first are going to find a generational unlock to having access to greater talent, to retaining that talent, and they will build an advantage around their human capital practices.
And one thing I would just note around having the courage to interrupt something that doesn't sit well with you in the moment is that it has a ripple effect. So we all know about the bystander effect of people always think someone else is going to do it. The opposite is also true. One voice can turn the tide. So you might think, oh no, I'm going to speak up and everyone's going to be feel uncomfortable. But maybe everyone felt uncomfortable when that person said that thing. And you leading the way can inspire others to speak out as well.
Love it. No, so very important. And again, can't believe we've got about 10 minutes left. So awesome. And got so many great comments here. In the book, you talk about the importance of middle managers in driving the change agenda. So, and that comes up in different conversations that I've had. Why are they so important? And then also, how can you most effectively engage those individuals in terms of driving this conversation and transformation?
Well, if you think about most organizations, most of the people, most of the humans report to the middle managers in the organization. And that's the level in an organization where the proverbial rubber meets the road. Most of our business lives are tended to by that middle level of leaders. I think we talk about in the book, a retail organization that has thousands of people. There's a few hundred folks that sit in these middle management jobs that really most of the human beings report to. So it can't be optional that the middle managers understand the values of the company, understand the commitments around building a more inclusive environment. So I think the way to help that set of leaders, we think training and education is certainly helpful, but also they need to have the right tools. Krista alluded to this, anything that is important in business, we measure it. So having the right measurement and then also the right reward system. There are lots of fantastic companies that have incentive systems that measure employee engagement and how well leaders execute against the values and principles espoused by the organization. So having good alignment between the strategy and the tools and the measurement, especially for that middle management group, is a really important aspect of operationalizing this work and systematizing this work. It needs to find its way into all the people, policies, and practices, and then brought to life through the middle management.
The only thing I would add when it comes to the importance of engaging middle management is that they are the closest to engaging with the public, you know, especially in these like public facing organizations, retail, restaurant, et cetera. The public perception of that organization is going to be filtered through these middle managers and the entry-level employees. So that work is extremely important to how you interact with a consumer.
And thank you again. Lots of comments coming through in the chat, and we've got about 5 minutes left. I've got another question from Bill, who said, I really love the focus on training and development. And so on top of empathy, which is critical, what are the key topics, skills that you feel that organizations need to focus more on developing so we can be more effective?
Well, I think empathy is certainly one of them in creating kind of shared experiences for us to learn and grow culturally. The other places where I've seen companies invest is in communication skills and how to have the difficult conversations, the crucial conversations that'll really benefit the business. The other place that I like to invest is around really leveraging the work in this space to benefit and strengthen the organization. That might be in how we show up in the community differently and more completely to attract more customers to our businesses or serve different sets of customers. And we've got examples in the book of companies and how they've used their work around diversity, equity, and inclusion to increase their customer base. And then obviously there's lots of work on building or undoing the bias in and around systems and helping people understand and better appreciate, you know, how to do that work and why the work is important. Krista, would you add anything?
One thing that came up when you were speaking just now was, we haven't touched much on this, but utilizing your employee resource groups, they're just a wealth of knowledge and innovation. And that's, I think you were kind of hinting at that, of one of the ways that companies can start looking at DEI as a business unit and of being able to attract more customers and just unlocking new sectors for the company.
Awesome. Well, and I've got maybe our last question from Charles, saying that congratulations on this great book. You clearly do important and timely consulting with organizations. What is the biggest aha that your clients seem to have when working with you?
I think the biggest surprise is just the straightforwardness and practicality of the work. I'm an operating executive, and we think that's what's unique about the book. So I've been the CEO of a public company. I sit on public company boards. I chair public company boards. And what we tried to do is really distill that experience in a way that leaders can take very practical actions that advance their business and create more and different spaces for all the humans to do their very best. We try to be, and I've learned this from Krista, to be very plain spoken and just straightforward around what this work is and what it isn't. This is about just being human. And if we can create spaces and practices and policies, there is a really important kind of generational unlock for leaders and companies that really get this work. Bottom line is that the leaders have to own it.
Yeah, I agree that the folks appreciate the directness, because I think a lot of times people walk on eggshells a little around leaders without telling them about themselves, really.
No, and I love that, and agree. In terms of, as you go through the book, and you, both of you have mentioned this term, you know, operationalization, bringing it to life, those practices. And so time has flown by. Thank you so, so much. Such an important conversation. I've got so many comments, questions still in the queue that we didn't get to. And again, it's such an important conversation. Any final thoughts that for the listeners today and those tuning in terms of the work that you've done and key messages for them to reflect on?
Craig, we love the platform that you've created. Again, this work is about being human, and it's about leading authentically. And I think the work that we all do as leaders is really important. This has become kind of our life's work around building inclusive leadership moving forward. We appreciate you, and we're grateful for the platform that you've created for the fantastic leaders that are on the program. So thank you.
Yes, thank you so much for having us. It's been a wonderful conversation. And I'd encourage people to just honor themselves and the humanity in others.
Awesome. And yes, and so, and to echo that, it's the thing that for me in hosting the Do Good to Lead Well podcast, I love the points that you make throughout the book, throughout the conversation today. It's about honoring ourselves. It's about bringing out the best in ourselves and in others, and being thoughtful around how we create those conditions and to have the conversations that matter. I just think it's so great. And it's a learning journey. We're all on a learning journey together. And to be open and talk about these things, that is the foundational step for us to be able to achieve great things. So thank you for all your work again, and so many comments coming in. Until next time, everyone, take care. A real pleasure to have you join us. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden, or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.